That's where houses were destroyed by Israeli airstrikes and bombings during the recent aggression on the territory. Sami draws the Palestinian flag as well as the map of Palestine on children's cheeks as patriotic symbols. She says she does that to say that these people in the midst of destruction will become strong again. Sami says by painting on kids' faces, she wants to send a message to the world.
I'm sending a message to the world that our children should live like other children in the world, away from danger and destruction. It is their right in life to live as children in a safe place, a place that gives them something to live a normal life.
Palestinian kids say they feel happy when Sami paints their faces. The Israeli regime launched its devastating onslaught on Gaza in early May. At least 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed during the 11-day war. A Turkish band has found musical inspiration in a most unlikely place, a local landfill. Here's more. Members of Funk Istanbul have assembled instruments from the dump in a junkyard in Istanbul. They use their ingenious new tools to play Turkish folk music. The band aims to raise awareness about recycling. Turkey is one of the biggest producers of municipal waste globally. The country has a low recycling rate. Only 12% of waste is repurposed there.
Technology has come in handy to rescue animals in disaster zones. American cinematographer Douglas Thrun has used a high-tech infrared drone to save animals from fire or storm, or even those who are stuck in trees. The drone he uses has a large thermal camera, a spotlight, and zoom lens. The good point is that the aerial vehicle does not make too much noise. Therefore, it does not scare away animals.
So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife, and then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Thrun has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the US and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
A video has gone viral showing animals at a U.S. zoo enjoying their bath time becoming clean as a new pimp. Keepers at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo washed the animals to celebrate International Bath Day. From anteaters to rhinos all got sprayed with a water hose. They seemed to love their bath time as it kept them cool in the summer heat. Zoo officials say the occasion is to honor ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who made a discovery while in the bath.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Educators and institutions from around the world have come forward as part of a vibrant and growing international movement in opposition to Israeli regime colonization and apartheid. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Emma Klein and Cameron Payne, authors. This article is published under the heading, Seattle Teachers Stand with Palestine. Stay tuned for more. In response to the ongoing Israeli regime colonization, occupation, and bombardment of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Al-Quds, on June 14, 2021, Seattle Education Association, C, representatives passed a new business item, NBI, in solidarity with the people of Palestine. Rooted in the principles of justice, human rights, and equality, the recommendation endorses the Palestinian call to boycott, divest, and sanction, or BDS movement, the Israeli regime, and the end the deadly Exchange Seattle campaign. The NBI passed by a 90% yes vote of Representatives Assembly. As Palestinian educators and members of C, they stand in strong support of this monumental recommendation. Palestinians are enduring a brutal Israeli regime occupation that has crushed the lives of millions of Palestinians and expelled hundreds of thousands from their homes. This issue may feel far away, but it is anything but. U.S. law enforcement agencies, including the Seattle Police Department, have participated in exchanges with Israeli regime forces, training with them on policies such as surveillance, restrictions of movement, repression of social movements, torture, and violence. We see these tactics carried out by the SPD in the horrific murders of Charlene Elias, Terry Carver, Derek Hayden, Damir Spatz, Isaiah Opet, Tommy Lee, Eugene Nelson, Robert J. Lightfeather, and countless others who have lost their lives at the hands of the SPD. Gazan students are unable to secure study permits to access educational opportunities in the West Bank, let alone internationally, forcing many students to drop out of school and repressing the academic output of Gaza. Roadblocks and curfews across the occupied territories lead to school closures for months at a time. The Zionist regime detention of Palestinian minors without charge and accountability disrupts Palestinian youth from accessing education and leads to deep trauma. The activist said, "In Seattle, we see trauma at the hands of SPD and the school-to-prison pipeline. BIPOC children and families are disproportionately targeted by police and incarcerated. As an academic institution that claims educational justice for all, it is crucial that Seattle public schools stand with students and families denied their right to education from Seattle to Palestine. This is not complicated at all." They said, "We cannot continue obscuring the power dynamics and systematic racism at play and equating state violence with the retaliation of the powerless. Calling for justice and holding Israeli regime accountable for its behavior." In the last year, Seattle Public Schools, SPS, released two official statements in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter, BLM, movement. BLM unequivocally stands for an end to incarceration, borders, racism, ethnic cleansing, and police brutality. The Zionist regime is mobilized by incarceration, borders, racism, ethnic cleansing, and police brutality. To stand with the BLM movement is to stand with the principles of the BLM movement in a global context, the activist said. The same way the United States systematically oppresses black lives and people of color, the Zionist regime is systematically oppressing Palestinians, Afro-Palestinians, as well as Jews of color. The Zionist regime is doing this with $4 billion in aid per year from the U.S. regime. Those who identify as Zionists cannot stand for Black Lives Matter. These two things cannot exist at the same time. Historically, some of the most iconic activists for Black Lives have irrefutably stood with Palestine and expressed the importance of Palestinian liberation. The C resolution is not an isolated action. Educators and institutions from around the world have come forward as part of a vibrant and growing international movement in opposition to the Zionist regime colonization and apartheid. Weeks ago, the United Educators of San Francisco and chapter chairs of the United Teachers of Los Angeles passed similar resolutions in solidarity with Palestinians. The teachers said, as C members and educators, we are proud to stand with Palestinian families, faculty, employees, and students of Seattle Public Schools. We will work to ensure that our recommendation is upheld, and we call on brave individuals and institutions like our own to join us. With each step, our movement in support of Palestine is growing.
On June 22nd, the U.S. government took down a range of Iranian news websites, including English-language Press TV and Arabic-language Al Alam, a far-reaching crackdown on the Iranian media. Press TV's users were faced with this message. The domain PressTV.com has been seized by the United States government in accordance with a seizure warrant pursuant. The message was part of a broader campaign against the resistance movement in West Asia, as some non-Iranian websites, like those belonging to Yemen's Al Masira TV channel and Bahrain's Lu'lu' television network, were targeted as well.
The move shows that the resistance front enjoys wide-spanning influence because the U.S. government has breached the values it claims to be upholding. The U.S. action is not the first of its kind. During the past 3 or 4 years, many measures have been taken to hinder Iran's speedy progress in the virtual space, from removing Iranian apps in violation of international laws to imposing sanctions on Iranian firms to prevent them from accessing software distribution platforms.
Shortly after, the U.S. Justice Department confirmed in a statement that, pursuant to court orders, the United States seized 33 websites used by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union, IRTVU, and 3 websites operated by Kata'ib Hezbollah, KH, in violation of U.S. sanctions.
The latest measure by the U.S. is against the same principles of free speech, which the country has always been proud of. That means curtailing free speech. The measure means that the U.S. is using tools to prevent the reflection of different viewpoints to the public. The Iranian government condemns this measure.
The seizure timing was suspicious enough, as it came one day after the Iranian president-elect Ebrahim Raisi ruled out a meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden while calling on Washington to lift sanctions on Tehran and rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Press TV was launched in 2007 with the motto of "The Voice of the Voiceless." Since the very beginning, the news channel has always tried to shed light on major regional and global issues from perspectives either ignored or distorted by the mainstream media. Over the past years, the channel has repeatedly been subject to censorship on multiple platforms, including Twitter and Instagram, besides Google and its services. For example, it was in mid-January 2020 that tech giant Google permanently removed Press TV UK's YouTube channel. The channel had over 28,000 subscribers on its YouTube account at the time of its deletion.
It just goes to show how wafer-thin all the Western propaganda about media freedom, freedom of speech, and so on really is. The truth is they want their overweening narrative to completely dominate the public discourse so that decisions made about Iran, war and peace, sanctions, not sanctions, the nuclear deal or not, they want those decisions to be made with an uninformed public.
A few years earlier, in 2013, Press TV was forced off the air in the UK after media regulator Ofcom revoked its license for allegedly breaching the Communications Act. Shortly after, the channel was also taken off air in North America.
I don't obviously agree with everything Press TV do, but what they do is they provide a means for dialogue and discussion and understanding of the Middle East, particularly, and not only the Middle East, but many other world issues. Now, this vital conduit of news and information is being closed off by the British government, who are blaming it all on Ofcom. The British government won't take any responsibility for this outrageous, tyrannical act.
In fact, Press TV has had a long history of poor treatment at the hands of the US state. In just one case, back in January 2019, the FBI illegally detained Press TV anchor Marzia Hashemi for 10 days on her visit to the United States.
Situation in the United States that individuals can be detained, arrested without charge.
I was treated in many cases worse than a common criminal, as if I was a mass murderer.
I was kidnapped. Kidnapping, transferring, shackling, imprisoning, taking off my hijab, and so many other things. They can call it legal, but we know that it is not legal. Why is it that in the jails here, that 98.5, if not more, of the people I saw were Black Americans? Why?
While it has become an everyday challenge for Press TV and its sister channels to deal with problems caused directly or indirectly by the US government on flimsy pretexts, a number of channels such as BBC Persian and Iran International, which seek subversive agendas inside Iran via spreading misinformation, are all immune to Washington's whims. A minor case of hypocrisy by the self-proclaimed champion of freedom of expression. It's not simply a practice of undermining journalism or free speech. It is an attack on the truth itself.
Any of these countries like China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, they are demonized and their media outlets are portrayed as foreign agents, which is quite incredible. And we've seen incredible hypocrisy in the sense that not only does the U.S. government falsely dub these fact-oriented, totally fact-based media outlets as supposed foreign agents, but even on social media, which is ostensibly independent from the U.S. government, but really we know that many of these big tech corporations in Silicon Valley are U.S. government contractors that closely follow the U.S. government line. They have also been labeling foreign government-backed media outlets like RT, like CGTN, like Press TV, labeling them as controlled by the Russian government, as Google says, and Google owns YouTube. And we've also seen Twitter do the same thing, and Facebook.
The fact is, the mission of Press TV's independent journalism, which is to set distorted narratives right across the region and the world, has made the channel a strong alternative voice for the oppressed. And that's not what the Americans can put up with.
The Western media and the West-controlled media, you know, or the what they call the mainstream media, they portray a particular thing, a particular, you know, international problem in a particular this frame. And Iranian, the Press TV is challenging that. Probably they are providing an alternative thought. So naturally, this is a competition. So in that competition, so Press TV is now facing the heat.
By way of comparison, what they've done to Press TV is a larger scale operation of what they've done to the founder of WikiLeaks and other whistleblowers across the world, muting alternative voices at any cost. In the words of Asa Winstonley, the Electronic Intifada, an online Chicago-based publication covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the action of the U.S. government in seizing these websites shows that this is the action of a gangster regime. It is the action of thugs, really. The U.S. government is no stranger to using the American monopoly over the means of communication online to shut down alternative voices from other countries. For example, in August 2018, Facebook deplatformed Venezuela-based outlets Telesur English, which offered differing opinions and analysis of the U.S. government's actions in Venezuela and Latin America. American scholar Richard Falk believes that by shutting down Press TV, the U.S. is attempting to deprive Iran of its capacity to challenge hostile propaganda and put forth its own counter-narrative of controversial events and more generally of peace, justice, and democratic governance. All in all, this is not the first time Press TV is targeted by the U.S., and by the looks of things, it will not be the last one. Fighting for the truth is what Press TV unflinchingly believes in, and it will never give it up, come hell or high water.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com
www.vox.com/en.
The Pentagon said recently the U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale of F-16 fighter jets as well as Sidewinder and Harpoon missiles to the Philippines in three separate deals with a combined value of more than $2.5 billion. We're prepared for an article written by Richard Javad Heydarian titled U.S.-Philippine arms deal aims at South China Sea. The article has been published by the Asia Times. With likely long-term strategic implications, the U.S. State Department cleared a multi-billion dollar arms package to the Philippines on 24th of June, which includes up to 12 state-of-the-art multi-role fighter jets. According to the proposed deal, the Pentagon is set to provide up to 10 F-16C Block 7072 aircraft and two F-16D Block 7072 aircraft manufactured by Lockheed Martin, as well as long-term training and assistance with maintenance of the aircraft. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency, DSCA, has also cleared the sale of 24 Raytheon Technologies AIM-9X Block II Sidewinder air-to-air missiles worth $42.4 million and 12 Boeing AGM-84L1 Harpoon Block II anti-ship missiles worth $120 million. Amid rising tensions in the South China Sea, the Philippine Defense Secretary, Delphine Lorenzana, emphasized how his country needs this multi-role fighters, especially that the situation in this part of the world is deteriorating. If approved, the $2.43 billion deal would be the largest of its kind in the history of the two allies, marking a dramatic elevation in bilateral defense cooperation. The timing of the announcement was also crucial, coming only weeks after the Philippines decided to again suspend the abrogation of the Visiting Forces Agreement, the VFA, until the end of the year. Should the two so-called allies finalize the deal in the coming months, it will set the tone for bilateral relations under the next Filipino president, who will assume power by June of 2022. For years, various Filipino leaders, especially current President Rodrigo Duterte, have fretted about America's long history of dumping Vietnam-era weaponry on its century-old ally. Earlier this year, President Duterte threatened to abrogate the VFA unless the U.S. provided $16 billion in defense aid to the Philippines, highlighting large-scale advanced weaponry that Washington has handed to other countries such as Pakistan, Egypt, and the Israeli regime over the past decade. Various American administrations, as well as the Pentagon, shunned the sale of state-of-the-art military hardware, raising concerns over the Philippines' ability to effectively maintain modern weaponry. chronic corruption and limited defense spending also torpedoed earlier efforts by various Filipino presidents to ramp up their country's defense acquisitions. Added to this has been half a century of rebellions across the Philippines' impoverished peripheries, which deprived the country's naval and air forces of much-needed resources for external defense in favor of the insurgency-focused army. In the 1990s, former Filipino President Fidel Ramos, a U.S. West Point-trained general, sought to modernize the country's defense capabilities, especially after the withdrawal of U.S. bases and the subsequent Chinese siege of Manila-claimed Mischief Reef in the South China Sea. Under Fidel Ramos, armed forces of the Philippines modernization program, the Southeast Asian country sought to acquire, among other things, advanced fighter jets, including 12 FA-18CD Hornets. However, the ensuing Asian financial crisis undercut the first serious attempt at revamping the country's armed forces. As a result, the country went from having one of the most advanced militaries in the region in the mid-20th century to lacking even a single fourth-generation fighter in the first decade of the 21st century. However, under former President Benigno Aquino, the Philippines launched its second version of the Armed Forces of the Philippines Modernization Program, the Revised Armed Forces of the Philippines Modernization Act, allocating billions of dollars to augmenting the country's air force and naval capabilities. During his first 3 years in office, the former president, Aquino, allocated $648.4 million for new acquisitions. Between 2013 and 2017, defense spending increased by 17%, with the former president allocating $1.73 billion for new procurements. Although his successor, President Rodrigo Duterte, had adopted a diametrically opposed foreign policy of warmer ties with China, his top generals have continued to build on former President Aquino-era reforms. Philippine Defense Secretary Delfin Lorenzana, a former defense attaché in Washington, took up the cudgels of the succeeding phases of the 15-year Armed Forces of the Philippines Modernization Program. Under the Horizon 2 phase, the Philippines allocated about $5.6 billion for augmenting the country's capabilities against the so-called external threats, including the acquisition of advanced frigates, strategic missile systems, and fighter jets. The Horizon 3 phase, which would fall under the next Filipino president, is set to cover the acquisition of, among other things, the country's first submarines. Thanks to former President Aquino's efforts, the Philippines has managed to acquire modern frigates as well as modern fighters. Korea Aerospace Industries FA-50PH, which were deployed during the recent standoff with China in the Whitsun Reef. Facing increasing tensions in the South China Sea, the Philippines is intent on acquiring multi-role fighter jets amid an arms race in the region, with China now rolling out its own fifth-generation stealth fighters. Defense Secretary Lorenzana said recently during his speech at Sandy Datu Air Defense Exercise in Base Air Base, which is close to the disputed Scarborough Shoal. He said, "We're pushing for the acquisition as it is critical capability for the defense of our country's territorial airspace from any form of threat and enforcement of Philippine Air Defense Identification Zone." Lorenzana, who talked to the Philippines' existing yet limited inventory of modern warplanes, said, "With multi-role fighter aircraft, we can explore the facets of air power." He added, "Likewise, it is imperative to fast-track the establishment of a standardized tactical data link so that all our assets may be able to talk to one another. The proposed F-16 deal with the United States falls under the Philippine $1.8 billion multi-role fighter acquisition project, or Horizon 2 project. After culling multiple bids from leading defense contractors, the country is now deciding between Sweden's much cheaper Saab JAS-39C Gripen or the U.S. much more advanced Block 7072 version of the F-16 fighter jet, which is commonly used by top North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO allies. Most defense experts agree that the F-16 fighter package is the runaway winner, but the Philippine defense chief has fretted that it is expensive for the Philippine Air Force. Defense Secretary Lorenzana told the Philippine Daily Inquirer recently, "The U.S. wants us to buy the F-16 jets. It's very expensive to the Philippine Air Force, and we're evaluating others." The final details of the proposed U.S. fighter jet deal, which also requires congressional approval, are still up for negotiations. Top Philippine defense officials may seek a better deal with their American counterparts in order to purportedly set the tone for more robust bilateral relations under President Duterte's successor beginning in 2022.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the UN Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba named Pastorkovac vaccine. Iran has also launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine dubbed Nura as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering. And I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received his first dose of the Coviron Barakat vaccine on Friday. Coviron Barakat vaccine was approved for emergency mass application by the country's health ministry earlier this month. Before receiving his first dose of the Coviron Barakat vaccine, the leader had set two prior conditions. First, insisting not to receive the vaccine outside the schedule that had been devised for the rest of the Iranians, and second, required to receive only Iranian vaccines. After receiving the jab, the leader thanked all those who were involved in the development of the homegrown vaccine. He said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he noted that he did not want to use a non-Iranian vaccine. That marked the leader's trust in Iranian scientists and his support for domestic production.
I think the first thing it says is that Ayatollah Khamenei himself is demonstrating his approval of this vaccine, and he's showing that he's leading by example in order to instill confidence, one would assume, within the populace as a whole. On the other hand, he's also making it very clear that this vaccine is one that he's accepted because it's produced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, independent of all others.
Coviron Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and it started to be mass-produced on March 29. That placed Iran among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. Under the hardest sanctions, Iran managed to produce its homegrown vaccine. Once again, Iranian scientists proved that nothing is impossible for the Iranian nation, as their will is strong enough to overcome any hardships, including sanctions. Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The US has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the US and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the U.S. aid operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad has said the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria. He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of US imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fiolet. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate
to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating Indigenous youth, but the schools subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson, and is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations? Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own Indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million Indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received. And that's just been passed down from generation to generation. It's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women have been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980, with activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. But First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
According to a draft report issued recently, the United Nations body UNESCO is recommending that Australia's Great Barrier Reef be included on a list of World Heritage in Danger, a move which has been heavily criticised by the Australian government. We're prepared for you an article written by Graham Redfern. The piece is titled, Why Australia's Great Barrier Reef May End Up on the World Heritage in Danger List, and What It Means. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Janelle Chanona is a former television news anchor in Belize, the tiny Central American country on the Caribbean Sea, famed for its World Heritage Barrier Reef, the second largest on the planet. She said, when things get really crazy above the waterline, I flee to the sea. Our reef speaks to the identity of every Belizean, and we say that with pride. Earlier this week, UNESCO recommended the planet's biggest, the Great Barrier Reef, should be placed on a list of World Heritage Sites in Danger. Janelle Chanona, who now leads a group of conservationists in the country for Oceania, knows exactly what that means. In 2009, the World Heritage Committee put Belize's Caribbean jewel on the same list. Illegal fishing, coastal and island developments, and the threat of oil and gas drilling meant the country wasn't doing enough to preserve the site. But just as Australia is now staring down the barrel of a perceived ignominy of the danger tag, Belize now looks back at it. The country, bordered by Mexico and Guatemala, introduced a raft of new laws to stop the disappearance of mangroves, regulate fishing, and outlaw oil and gas exploration. In 2018, the World Heritage Committee scratched the in danger status. Now the Belize government has a new Ministry of Blue Economy and has renewed hope for its reefs. Janelle Chanona says, we want to stay vigilant now.